listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process, when those two women confronted and yelled at Senator Jeff Flake with the open elevator door, some people characterized it as a powerful process-changing moment. To some, it was awkward, maybe even cringeworthy. And again in the process, in different ways, that moment when Judge Kavanaugh exhibited tears in his testimony to some people emphasized the point and his personal truth. For others, emphasized the point that this is an awkward process that should not be this way. I bring all this up because a Sacramento author, Melissa Dahl, who is also senior editor at New York Magazine's The Cut, she leads the health and psychology coverage, has been working on the subject of awkwardness. And her new book is titled Cringeworthy. And though when she came in here today, this was not meant to be a political conversation, I think many moments over the past weeks fit right into the discussion. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Are you game for the direction that I just took this topic?
I am definitely game. It's all anyone can think about lately. So
your book approaches this as our sense of our tribal self. Mm-hmm. When are we awkward? What's happening in our brain? What do we perceive with everybody else? But I think our awkwardness and confusion was really on national display recently.
Absolutely. I mean, the moment you mentioned in the elevator, you know, I mean, these moments of awkwardness are kind of like they're moments of social disruption where something doesn't go as we thought it would, you know. And I became so interested in these moments. They're kind of secretly pretty profound, actually. You know, we sense when these things deviate from the norm. And what do we do with that discomfort when these moments happen?
When you say, what do we do? Another good example is when the president was at the rally and began mocking Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And you freeze frame mm-hmm. the shot and see all the different reactions of the people behind. Mm-hmm. Where some cheered, some looked stunned, mm-hmm. some were unsure.
What do I do?
You really mm-hmm. get the whole spectrum. So what made you focus yourself on awkwardness?
Well, so, I mean, I have a joke in the book that I've kind of been unofficially studying it for about 30 years. But
I'm not sure you have more claim to it based
know,
on your examples than anybody else. But
I know. So I've been covering health and psychology as a journalist for the past decade or so. And something I've always loved about the job is anytime I'm curious about some aspect of human behavior, I can kind of go to the science and see what people have uncovered. And there wasn't kind of a grand theory of awkwardness to be immediately found in the literature. And so I kind of went to create my own. I was just so curious about these moments that make us uncomfortable, that are so common. And what do they say about us? What do they say about how we're perceived? And what do we do with those feelings? So those were the questions I tried to answer.
I mentioned that tribal aspect, mm-hmm. and I think that's so fascinating in the beginning that there are studies describing how people are before they know what they look like.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. You're talking about, I came across this report from an anthropologist back in the late 60s, early 70s. He went to Papua New Guinea, to this really remote area where he was pretty sure the folks there had never seen what they looked like. You know, there were no mirrors, there were no cameras. The waters where they lived were kind of too shady for them to really get a glimpse of their reflection. And so, for better or for worse, he decided to change that. And he came with a photographer, and he brought them cameras, video cameras, tape recorders, mirrors. And he wrote down the reactions and published it years later. And he used language like you know, they cowered, they covered, you know, they crouched, they covered their mouths, they ducked their heads. And their reaction just to me sounded like what I do, you know, when I cringe at myself, you know, when I kind of get a glimpse of what I must look like to somebody else. And when it doesn't quite match up to the version of myself I had in my head. So that was one of the things where I thought these moments are secretly profound. They kind of speak to our identity and our place in the world.
But now American culture in particular, but other cultures as well, have gone very far the other way with selfies and social media and how much we want to put some of that on exhibit. And in a way, it's also airing out awkwardness and cringeworthy yeah. moments. We're documenting them and examining them differently.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, And, you know, a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm came back last year, which is one of the most cringeworthy things in pop culture. It is something that I think we're all pretty interested in right now.
Do you have an event coming up here in Sacramento?
I sure do. I sure do. Yes. So I went to Sac State. I graduated in 2007, and I will be speaking there tomorrow about my book, about kind of the writing process, about things that make me cringe at 3 p.m. I need to double check the location. Maybe you have that.
I don't have it right in front of me, but yes, 3 p.m. tomorrow at Sac State.
Yes.
We will have that on our website as well. I'm talking with Melissa Dahl. She is senior editor at New York Magazine's The Cut. She has been talking about her health and psychology coverage. Her new book is titled Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. So let's advance it farther to where you took this theory and what you came to believe after focusing so much on this uncomfortable experience of being human.
Yeah. So I really think that these moments kind of they allow us to look at ourselves from someone else's point of view. There's this psychologist, Philippe Rochat at Emory, who calls these moments, illuminates the irreconcilable gap is what he calls them. And it kind of shows the distance between the version of yourself you think you're showing to the world and the version of the world is actually seeing. And so to me, what you can do with that is maybe take that information in. I mean, we're always telling kids and, you know, people like, oh, doesn't matter what people think of you, but it does. It matters to all of us and it should matter. I mean, we should care what people think of us. Sometimes that's important to kind of correct our behavior and become the version of ourselves we wish we were. So
what's your conclusion about awkward silence?
Well, I think there are so many different ways that you can kind of weaponize awkwardness in a way. Awkward silences. I had this friend of mine who works at a big newspaper who had a boss who was famous for if someone came in, you know, asking for a raise or asking for a promotion, he would just sit there and there would be silence. And the joke was that by the end, you know, people would just like do anything to break the silence. And they would say, oh, never mind. I'll take a pay cut. I'll take a demotion. But I think if you can kind of, you know, withstand the silence, you can sometimes use that, you know, you can use that an uncomfortable feeling to make a point or, you know, I mean, my therapist does it all the time, you know, to make me be a little more forthcoming. So if you can find a way to become more comfortable with it, it's interesting to see what happens.
What have you learned to do with your own experience of awkwardness? And I'm asking that question about you in particular, but also for all of us to learn.
So one of the most important things personally that I took away from this book that I use all the time. You know, I'm a pretty self-conscious person. I'm a pretty, you know, probably socially anxious person. And folks who study self-consciousness specifically in sports, this was kind of an interesting field to draw from, say that focusing on yourself, you know, like a golfer or something, that'll make them kind of screw. I don't know anything about sports, but it'll make them screw up, you know, on their putt or whatever. And so what they say is, it's important to get them to focus on anything but themselves, anything but the minute, you know, things their body are doing or whatever. And for me, my kind of translation of that has been to when I'm here talking about my book, I'm not focusing on myself. I'm trying to focus on these messages that I think are important. You know, the key is to focus on anything but yourself, and then that self-conscious aspect should go away.
So do you have a little trick that gets you out of yourself or out of your head quickly?
I mean, for this specifically, it's kind of doing the work beforehand, you know, and making sure like, I want to get this message across. And that's what I'm focusing on. I'm not focusing on myself and, you know, how many times I've said like in the last 15 minutes. But
and with that, you gave me a very good note, and I will read it, that yes, in fact, you are speaking at 3 p.m. tomorrow at Sac State. It is at the Harper Alumni Center at Sac State. So there's the location. I want to add that there is brain science and biochemistry research, and you did look at how our body responds in a way that we can't control when some part of our brain says, we're in one of those moments.
Yeah. So specifically, I went to Germany and I found these two researchers who I swear have to be the only people in the world who are as obsessed with this subject as me. But they specifically study, they're neuroscientists, and they study secondhand embarrassment. And they wanted to know what happens in the brain when you see someone else embarrass themselves, or you see some other kind of cringeworthy experience happen. And what they found is the area of your brain that kind of becomes active is the same area that has to do with empathy. Like, people who are really highly empathetic tend to experience secondhand embarrassment more strongly. So that just kind of was such an endearing fact to me, that people who feel this more strongly, people who, you know, can't watch Curb Your Enthusiasm or can't watch, back in the day, American Idol auditions or something like that. It's because you feel this connection to somebody else and you feel it as if it's happening to you. It's a really compassionate feeling. It can be.
Didn't you write about that, that you were dating someone who couldn't watch the bad auditions on American Idol because there was just such a visceral reaction
for
him? He
would have to get up and leave the room. Yeah, he would just be like, oh, I can't do it. So,
Well, let me circle back around to where we started this, which was what's happened over the last couple weeks. And a very common phrase now, especially in younger generations, is that awkward and kind of announcing when we're in a cringeworthy moment. Do you think we learned anything over the last couple weeks about how we behave and how we behave in front of each other and on very big stages?
One thing that maybe my book can contribute, and I hope maybe something we are learning in the last couple of years, is that sometimes it's okay to make it weird. Sometimes it's okay to be disruptive. Sometimes it's okay to make a scene. There are times when you should follow the social norms, and there are times to disrupt them. And, those women in the elevator, they did not follow social cues, and they had some really powerful words to say. They made it kind of weird for Jeff Flake, and I'm so glad they did. And I hope more of us can be brave enough to make things awkward sometimes.
Melissa, when you're back in town, please stop by again. There are so many aspects of the work that you could do that we could have interesting conversations about.
I'd love to, yeah.
And Melissa Dahl's book is Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. She will be at the Harper Alumni Center at Sac State tomorrow at 3 p.m. And she is an editor and writer at New York Magazine. You can find her work there. Again, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This is Insight on Cap Radio.